ESARP's Global Economy Podcast. My name is Fredrik Eriksson, and today I'm talking to David Henning. David is a colleague of mine here at ESARP, where he, among other things, directs the UK trade policy projects. David was previously a senior official at the UK Department for International Trade, and he's one of the leading experts in the UK on trade policy. And this is also what I'm going to talk to David about today: the direction of UK trade policy, where it's going, who is negotiating with, and what is it trying to accomplish with its independent trade policy. David, welcome to the podcast again.
Thank you, Frederick.
So let's start with this sort of evergreen topic, Brexit, and talk a little bit about where we are right now. So could you start by painting us a picture about the negotiations between the EU and the UK? How are they going? What are the most difficult parts of these negotiations? For some time now, we have grown used to a lot of commentary suggesting that these negotiations cannot finish on time. Lately, there has been a slightly more positive tone coming out from both Brussels and London. So does that mean that optimism about the future relation between the UK and the EU is now called for?
Well, the UK has in fact left the EU. This is sometimes forgotten because in terms of trading relationships, we'll still be in the same status until the end of this year. So new trading relations start from 1st January 2021. We are in the transition period now. And what we see in talks is that we're headed for the third consecutive autumn. We will have a deal or no deal point. We recall the first time there was a proposed deal between the UK and the EU was October 2018. Then there was one again in October 2019. And we look like we'll make it three in a row this year, that in order to be an agreement, it would have to be reached around about in October, which of course would be record time for any trade agreement. So far, talks have been, well, like trade talks often are. They've made quite a slow start, a lot of demonstrating back to domestic audiences that both sides are going to be tough with the other, that they are not going to compromise. We expect to see this early on in trade talks, of course, but this time there is rather less time available to do so. So between March and June, both sides published their objectives, they both sides published their draft texts, and both sides published letters to each other and various press statements accusing each other of not being particularly serious. This came to a head in a virtual summit between Prime Minister Johnson and the three EU presidents, at which both sides agreed, in very much in keeping with normal trade talks, to intensify efforts to find common ground. And that was the reason for the optimism rising, was that both sides had agreed this timetable. So now we are in an intensification. We've had talks for a couple of weeks, finally person-to-person talks. The UK chief negotiator David Frost went to Brussels. Michel Barnier came to London. So the teams are now meeting each other. There is no sign of any immediate progress, but the EU has indicated where compromises may be possible. The UK has yet to reciprocate, but we are now in the point where both sides are starting to stake out the territory. What is essential to them and what is desirable? And from that can come the point at which we can see if there is a deal. We think that there is a deal potentially on the table that both sides could agree to, but as yet, we're not quite sure how the two sides might find that deal.
All right. So for all of those people that may be listening to this podcast that are not following Brexit very closely, what would you say sort of are the key sticking points? What are the key areas where things need to happen, where compromises need to be sought for things to move on?
So the main areas of difference between the two sides, as expressed in public, are that the EU is demanding quite strict rules for what they're calling the level playing field. This is rules on state aid, labour and environment standards. They are saying that they want to be sure that there is fair competition in order to give the UK full tariff-free access to their market. The UK is saying, they don't wish to go further than Canada or Japan went in those agreements. So that is an area of disagreement, although we think that that could be fixed. There does seem to be a halfway house there. Fisheries is a difficult issue, traditionally outside of trade talks, but this is quite a comprehensive package that the two sides are talking about. The UK has reclaimed, if you like, the fishing rights, and UK waters are quite extensive. The EU had asked for the same access for EU fishing fleets as had previously been the case within the EU, almost accepting that that was unlikely, but it was a starting point. The UK have merely said that maybe every year we could have talks about what access could be given, which is very much a very minimal offer towards the EU. However, most of the UK fish that is caught in our waters actually is sold into the EU. So again, it looks like there should be a solution possible there. There are a number of areas where the UK is asking for a little bit more than others have had. Almost by virtue of being in geographical proximity, this would, for example, in terms of road haulage, but also in terms of professional qualifications, rules of origin, and indeed some recognition of products conformity assessment. The EU has made quite a minimal offer, as far as we can see, in free trade agreement terms, simply to reduce tariffs, but very little at this moment in terms of those subjects. Again, one can see possibly how you could find a compromise. The final big issue where there is a dispute is that the EU would like a single governance structure, that is to say, one agreement covering all the different topics, whether that's cooperation on justice and home affairs, or fisheries, or trade. The UK would prefer separate agreements. It is hard to see why this should become such a big issue, but this may be one of the issues that is hardest to solve, if you like. The EU have an issue. They don't like their relationship with Switzerland, which is based around multiple agreements. And the UK, conversely, think that that would potentially give us more leverage. So there is much to work out there. Then, in addition, there are the many details that form part of free trade agreements normally, whether that is the product-specific rules of origin or any specific quotas, if there were to be such, many of which could yet burst into bigger issues. But we don't have time for that, so it might be a case of settling the big issues and then agreeing on a fairly standard text.
One area you didn't mention, David, is services. I suppose there are quite a lot of people who may have followed Brexit from sort of more of a general point of view, who will have heard lots of commentary from both sides on the issue of services. From the UK side, I mean, this has been seen as sort of an area where UK trade tends to be strong, where firms are competitive, where integration with the EU market is very strong. On the EU side, we've heard at least initially a few defensive points around services, avoiding that the UK could be given some privileged status outside the EU, but at the same time accessing the EU services market. So could you sort of give us an idea about what is going to happen to services? Did you not mention it because all issues have been resolved, or because both sides have basically lowered ambition so much that this is no longer a critical issue?
Services is a very interesting area of UK trade policy. As you say, it is a UK strength. The UK is the world's second largest services exporter. And yet, the UK's priorities for an EU trade agreement, or indeed for any of our others, do not emphasise services very much. We have a big ask in professional qualifications, where we want full recognition to continue. That seems unlikely. We have not made a special ask with regard to national treatment or market access for services. Financial services equivalents would be something given by the EU. Similarly, data equivalents. And these are processes that are going on to the side of talks. They will be influenced by the talks. But in general, the UK's approach looks rather orthodox, which is to say it is mostly about reduction of tariffs down to zero and very little about what could actually maintain the UK's competitive advantage with regard to services. It is one of the oddities of the UK government's approach that services do not seem to have any special place.
I'd like us to talk a little bit more about that, David, but first, sort of a final question on Brexit. So what would happen if there is no agreement when the implementation period ends? What happens then?
Well, as of January the 1st, 2021, we will be trading on WTO terms between Great Britain and the EU. And I say Great Britain rather than the United Kingdom. Northern Ireland is covered by the Withdrawal Agreement and the Northern Ireland Protocol, which for goods trade keeps them aligned with the EU, both in terms of customs and in terms of regulations. So there will be less effect there with regard to trade with it on the island of Ireland, but there will be an impact clearly between both Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and also between England and France, the crossing from Dover to Calais. And with no agreement, one can expect considerable barriers to trade to arise, and there to be no particular way to resolve these, no dialogue. So no customs cooperation, considerable checks on all animal products, many other food products. So a real rise in trade barriers affecting the UK. There will be a rise in trade barriers affecting the UK even if there is a deal, but it will be more sudden and there will be less of a structure to deal with the issues. In particular for the UK as well, we think it would affect manufacturing more than services. Over 50% of UK manufacturing exports go to the EU and the countries as closely aligned with EU trade policy, that is Norway, Iceland, Turkey, Switzerland. Without that critical mass, it would be very difficult to see how some UK manufacturing is sustainable, and indeed that includes the car industry, and Nissan, as part of their restructuring within Europe, even said that their plant in the UK would be unsustainable in that situation.
So far, at least when listening to what the British government has said, the intention seems to be that they are going to exit the implementation period come what may. If there is no agreement, well, then there is no agreement and they're going to trade in WTO terms. I mean, that seems to be sort of a type of cliff edge type of exit, which is going to have pretty strong economic consequences for the UK. Do you believe that the British government is actually prepared to do that? Or do you think that there is a degree of openness to extending the implementation period a little bit longer?
I think that the UK government is happy for there to be no trade deal at the end of the year. They have got into their minds the idea that the UK will be fine, we will survive without a trade deal, that some of the regulatory alignment parts are exaggerated, that the economic models and the forecasts of losses are probably exaggerated, and that the EU needs to know that we're serious about walking away and that might help us to get a better deal. So on that basis, I do not think there is any interest at the moment in extending. I do not even think they realise that the trade relationship between Great Britain and Northern Ireland will be much easier if there is a deal between the UK and the EU. So I don't think they are seeing the full picture at the moment. Whether they do start to see that, and I think the Nissan announcement, which came at the start of June, was significant in perhaps opening a few eyes that no trade deal would have some longer term consequences, which they may be blamed for. We wait to see just how seriously the UK is willing to negotiate in September and October in particular. Are we, as the UK government, prepare to make some difficult concessions at that point, because it will have to get a deal. But they, at the moment, appear to be quite prepared to walk away without one.
All right. Thank you, David. Let's leave the Brexit issue for a moment, because I want to talk to you about the UK developing its own trade policy. I mean, you've written a few papers about this, about what is important for Britain now when it is building up its own trade policy. And I was meaning sort of to ask you more generally to start with sort of how the government and key stakeholders have performed so far. But let's come to that in a moment. And I'd like to pursue the discussion we had in a while ago a little bit more, when you mentioned that there is an oddity here in the way that the UK has formulated its trade policy priorities. On the one hand, having a strong services sector with competitive firms that are globally oriented, and on the other hand, this not being a priority at all in UK trade policy. I mean, to me, that sounds really, really strange. I can't think of any country in the world where there is such a gap between, on the one hand, your own domestic comparative advantages, and on the other hand, the way you prioritize issues in trade policy. Why has the UK ended up in this strange position?
Yes, I think it is a strange position not to be obviously prioritising services. And there are a number of explanations, and I think they overlap. I don't think that there is any single explanation for this. I mean, obviously, one is that services is still not well developed in free trade agreements. They still don't make a significant effort. And you can argue that politically, the UK needs to deliver free trade agreements. That was with the promise. And that, if you like, we will come back to services. It won't matter so much. I'm not sure about that, but I could see some logic in the idea of just trying to get moving with trade agreements. Another is that the government has not really thought about what can be done to support the UK services sector. The sector is quite diverse. There is considerable difference between, for example, financial services or construction services, legal, films, universities, and that developing that broad range of policies simply hasn't really happened, still less what would benefit from trade policy. It's only really starting to happen now. So I think you can expect to see more of that in the future, but for the time being, it hasn't really happened. I think that there is a quite old-fashioned, orthodox view in the heart of the UK government that trade is more about goods and tariffs and more about finished goods. It is a little odd to hear that being said, alluded to at the very least, but that is what happens. Even to the extent we hear very little about regulatory alignment or cooperation, we hear mostly about regulatory independence. So this brings us to another potential reason, which is that Brexit was about independence. Services trade is often about trying to change regulations, and that is a little inconvenient at the moment of Brexit. So I think a number of explanations possible, none of them make for particularly flattering listening. It just seems an area that has been a little bit forgotten and to which the government will have to come back to. And I think from my point of view as an analyst of this, the concern is the UK will be giving away tariff-free access to our market without getting anything in return, which will be significant for services. So we will lose some bargaining power without getting anything in return. But it's not clear from a UK point of view exactly what you should be asking for. And I think not enough work has been done on that anyway.
All right. Thanks, David. So on my more general point then, I mean, you outlined in a paper not that long ago after the Brexit referendum, what would be sort of the key elements for the British government and for the British economy more generally when it now begins to build up its own independent trade policy. What are those sort of key features or the most sort of prioritized areas that you pointed to, and how has the UK government and key stakeholders performed so far?
progress has certainly been made by the UK government. We have a trade policy team that is now arguably larger than either in the US or the EU. We have 730 government officials directly working on trade policy in the Department for International Trade, and doubtless many others across government. So in that sense, we can clearly see progress. But in terms of the more analytical measures that we can use, slightly disappointing. I think the biggest disappointment is in what I call consensus. Is there a broad agreement within the UK as to what we are trying to achieve with trade policy? And the answer is there is not. There are disagreements both between the London government and the devolved administrations in Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland, between political parties. Most people in the UK would agree that trade broadly is a good thing, but beyond that, we don't really know for what we want to achieve with it. Now, we have put forward our negotiating objectives, mandates for trade talks with the US, Australia, New Zealand, Japan. These are, as I've mentioned already, rather orthodox, rather focused on trade in goods. So that's good, though, that we've managed to put those mandates forward. Less good that they are perhaps rather traditional and not very forward-looking. Structures have been set up with stakeholders, but they're not quite delivering, and that's not just down to government. Government is consulting better than it has been, still not ideally. I think as well that business has not fully stepped up to being ready, and stakeholders now are starting to say, oh, what should we be ready for in terms of future UK trade policy, which seems a little bit late. So a little bit behind the times on that. In the area of what I consider fairness, is the UK government taking a fair approach to both developed and developing countries, to firms large and small? Yes, a little bit, but again, more could be done there. And in terms, I think, of the overall planning, are we on track to actually deliver what we hope to deliver? That is, free trade agreements with the EU, the US, Japan, Australia, New Zealand, potentially joining the Comprehensive and Progressive Trans-Pacific Partnership, not to mention replicating arrangements that we were a party to with the likes of Turkey, Norway, Mexico, Canada that haven't been agreed. That is a huge workload, and it's not obviously prioritised, and some concerns there. So progress has been made, but still a little bit short of where we would hope to be at this point.
So looking then more generally, and sort of asking for your advice on what the British government would do now, what would you point to? And let's park sort of the issue about specific negotiating initiatives for a while, and just look at the scene a bit more generally. What do you think is sort of the most important things that the government needs to do now in order to formulate and sort of structure its own trade policy in a better way?
I think what I would like to see are some UK government policy papers on different subject areas. You could have one on services, that's probably too broad, maybe on e-commerce, but also an issue that has arisen in the UK debate is animal welfare, environment. If the UK government could perhaps put out short policy papers with their objectives in these areas and asking for comments, I think that would start to build the consensus and indeed the policy development that we need. And in fact, we have already seen this having to happen. The UK government has set up a food and trade commission under pressure from the farmers in this country. Well, I think that's an opportunity to build the consensus. So I would be very much focused on building that consensus and finding a way to channel these conversations. There are a couple of more things that I would suggest. One, going back to our services conversation, I think the UK should be seriously considering finding a willing partner or two and establishing a services plurilateral from the ground up, if you like, trade in services agreement, but from the ground up, and saying, here is what we would like to achieve in services. Anyone can join who is willing to. I think that would be a great boost for the UK and potentially the economy, and also for trade in services generally. That as well would be important, as well as getting our policy position in place. I think those would be the main two.
A final question sort of on this particular topic, David. So resistance or opposition to an open trade agenda traditionally comes from two different forces. One is going to be sort of those who may be ideologically not positioned to favor trade. The other one will be different type of economic interest sectors that fear competition from abroad and that would like to see border barriers that ease the conditions that they have for producing and selling to consumers. My question here is, has there been any sector in the UK that has gone sort of in more protectionist direction in the past years and that are looking towards Brexit as an opportunity to get more protection than they had when the UK was a member of the EU?
I don't think there is a sector that is looking for more protection than they had as members of the EU, but the UK has been discovering the power of the farming lobby that perhaps we were ignoring while we were members. I wouldn't describe the farming lobby as outright protectionist, but certainly wary of trade and wary of how it might affect them. So that is one to watch. As yet, other sectors that stand to be affected, well, the main ones are down to an EU trade deal and something like the automotive sector or perhaps steel. You don't hear much from them. They know that they need to trade. Not much from the steel sector. It's quite small in the UK anyway. So I would say that broadly there is still support for trade. There is not much of an appetite for campaigns against trade, but there could be appetite for campaigns against trade specifically with the US, which always seems to be something that attracts opposition. And it was for that reason that we were concerned about the UK starting trade talks with the US. We've been through this before and were worried that it would draw out all the opposition. And I think that is what has happened. I think if we are going to see protectionist moves, we may see that in the next year. But at the moment, I don't think I'm seeing it in general. We do, of course, like many other countries, have some questions being raised at the moment about trade with China.
All right. So let's move to the negotiations with the United States right away. I mean, it was a bit surprising that the UK wanted to press ahead with negotiations with the United States so soon after leaving the EU. While one can see sort of the political logic behind it, it is obvious that the United States is one of the most difficult countries to negotiate with, partly because they have strong interests and they are not shy of making sure that these interests are going to be catered for in agreement, but also because there are some additional political difficulties, if we can call them that. And one of them, of course, sits in the White House. So how has these negotiations played out so far? Are they making progress? Is the sort of the political resistance to the agreement, is that proving strong enough in order to slow things down to the point where you can have hesitations about whether this agreement is going to happen at all?
Well, both, in fact. Both the talks are making progress. There were already some pre-talks while the UK was still EU members. There were at least six rounds of pre-talks. So the two sides had got to know each other a little, had been talking to each other already, and are now talking about texts. But equally, the resistance has been building as well, particularly from the UK farming community, as I'd mentioned, who suggest that duty-free imports of farm produce from the US produced under conditions that they themselves would not be allowed to produce to is undermining UK farming. And we know in trade policy world that undermining farming communities is a very difficult and sensitive subject. So that is continuing. And even as I speak the day after, some tractors were driving around Parliament in protest against this. This is the first time I can remember tractors in Parliament for some years, and it just shows the potential power of the lobby. I think it is getting to the point where we don't know if a trade agreement can be reached with the US. We're probably running out of time for this year anyway with President Trump, and then next year the Trade Promotion Authority runs out as well. So we may well be looking at 2022. But the reason for doing this, it's very much a political agreement. This was a key part of Brexit for many leading Brexiteers. A US trade deal was essential. And for many of them, this was also an opportunity to slightly undermine the EU, if you like, to side with the US in terms of ongoing trade conflicts with the EU in agriculture and food. So politically, it remains very important. But of course, some of those political reasons are also the reasons why it would be unpopular in the UK. So at this stage, we are not able to say whether this could proceed, particularly as the US does not offer very much in return in a trade agreement. So it's not obvious that we can see the benefit for the UK in a US trade deal.
What about Japan? I mean, this is an agreement where the UK right now is party to an FTA through the EU. And now there are talks between UK and Japan about this agreement itself. How are these talks advancing?
We know less about the UK-Japan talks, but we think that they need to reach quite swift agreement for any deal to be ratified by the Japanese parliament. So that would be by, I think, the start of September. So we should know very soon. In reality, these should not be too difficult. We think that it is a matter of the UK getting perhaps a little bit less in food and agriculture than the EU received. Some changes in the data and digital provisions. Perhaps the addition of the investor state dispute settlement that Japan is quite attracted to and was not in the EU agreement. And perhaps bringing forward the tariff elimination on automotive as compared to the EU schedule, where the tariffs would not be fully eliminated until the 2025, I think. So I think that that agreement could be reached, and it is important for the UK to do so. It's also not only for its own economic value, but also as a potential gateway to the CPTPP I already mentioned.
The UK is also making a bid, right, to, well, not geographically move the UK out of Europe and join the Asia-Pacific region. But it's talking about a membership in the Comprehensive and Progressive Agreement on the Trans-Pacific Partnership. How likely is that, do you think?
Well, it's very attractive for the UK government to join with the 11 countries who are part of it. It's attractive economically, but also politically. Some countries like Japan are worried that the UK leaving the EU may move away from international rules on trade, and CPTPP ensures that we are kept within that. It is difficult for the UK, though, because this is text that already exists, text that we would have to sign up to, that potentially means changing the way we deal with food products, the way we run technical standards away from the European system, maybe some intellectual property elements as well. So it is not an easy decision for the UK if we assume that we have to take the text as it is rather than negotiate on it. So I think this is another big point will be reached in the next year where the UK government will have to decide, are we prepared to sign up to somebody else's regulations, in this case the CPTPP country's text, now that we have left the EU? The concept of regulatory independence, which has been so important to the UK and EU talks, is now going to be tested in talks with the CPTPP countries.
So finally, David, a question on the World Trade Organization. In the past days, we have seen the UK throwing its hat into the ring, sort of appointing Liam Fox to become the next Director General for the WTO, or at least the British government wants him to be the next DG of the WTO. Would you say that this reflects a broad interest on the part of the UK to take more leadership in the WTO in the future? Is that sort of part of building up its own independent trade policy, that it wants to invest more political capital in not necessarily protecting, perhaps building up more relevance and integrity at the WTO?
Right now, I don't think the WTO is a priority for the UK. I think we are talking about it being a priority. We're talking about the importance of the multilateral system and the Fox candidacy shows that we want to take the WTO seriously, but we haven't realistically done very much thinking about the issues at the WTO, whether they are about China and state subsidies or special and differential treatment, the appellate body. Very little thinking has been done in reality. The bilateral agreements are a much higher priority to the UK. So I think we can either see the Fox candidacy as a candidate, an individual candidate who very much wanted to be nominated, and the government feeling that, yes, why not? Maybe a little bit of a sign of saying, look, you know, we're back, we're allowed to do this, but maybe we're not doing it in a fully wholehearted manner. And just a marker for the future, you know, we will be interested in posts in the future. I think there is a potential for the UK to have a good voice in the WTO as a supporter of trade, but it will take us a little bit of time, and at the moment it looks a little bit over keen to say that almost the system has been waiting for the UK to save it, which sometimes is what it feels like. I think that more like a better line from the UK government would be to say, we are ready to help and to join with other countries that also want to help the WTO to survive and then thrive. We see a little bit of sign of that. I hope we see more of a sign of it in the future. But certainly in the UK, there is no great expectation that we will have the winning candidate for the next Director General of the WTO.
And really final now, David, another question. So one of the problems that has confronted the WHO for quite some time sort of is the difficulties of integrating a large systemically important country like China into a rules-based organization that is trying to, in broad terms, advance the principles of the market economy. We've seen both other large systemically important countries like the United States and European Union having greater frustrations with China. We're also seeing that many developing economies and emerging economies have fears about China's economic dominance. My question here is, how is the UK planning to deal with trade policy issues vis-a-vis China? On the one hand, we heard ahead of the Brexit referendum that many leading Brexiteers thought about leaving the EU as a way to stepping into the world, doing trade deals with countries like China. On the other hand, now we're seeing increasing frictions between the UK and China, not least over Hong Kong, but also on matters like cybersecurity, whether Chinese firms should be available to build up 5G infrastructure in the UK. What does this all mean for UK-China trade policy relation?
I think at the moment we are seeing a turn against China. We had been quite strong advocates of trade with China up until 2016. At the moment, it feels like we are now following a US lead of suspicion towards China, suspicion towards trade with China, but without an underlying strategy behind it. So if we're about to weaken our trade relations with the EU, potentially weaken them with China, and only maybe strengthen them a little with the US, that is still, in terms of individual countries, I think that is 11 of the top 12 individual trade partners where we will have weaker relations in the future. That is a risky situation to be in. And so whilst I can understand at the moment why we are looking with a sceptical eye over China, I think the future for the UK has to be to balance trading interests with the EU, with the US and with China, and to try to support an open trading system which says these are and should be the rules and we will trade with anybody according to those rules. I fear that we are in danger of going against that, which I don't think is in our interests, but is understandable given the global political climate. And I'm hoping the UK can kind of step back from that and head back towards, we support the system and we want to trade.
All right, David, many thanks for taking your time to record this podcast. It's been a very informative, what is it now, 45 minutes that we recorded this. So thank you very much.
Thank you.